Kim to give us the kind of research, academic, larger picture background, but as the other piece of our speakers tonight, we wanted to hear the voice of a teacher who's seen and lived through the various policy and collective agreement provisions around class size that we've lived through as teachers over the past 20 or 30 years. And so we invited a teacher named Kate Noakes, who's going to be our next speaker. Kate started teaching in secondary school, teaching English in Revelstoke in 1977. She has a BA from York University, did her PDP at SFU, and recently completed a master's with a focus on language arts at the University of Lethbridge in 1998. She's been involved in her local association in various capacities, including staff rep and local rep. This year she's teaching English 11 and 12, and also is working on literacy initiatives at Fernie Secondary School. Next semester she'll teach English 10, 11, 12, and Literature 12. She's also the mother of two teenage children, so she has that sort of parental credibility as well. So I'd like you to welcome Kate to come and talk to us.
This is about right. Maybe down a little. Thank you very much. Kim, it actually leads in nicely to what I have to say because I want to open with talking briefly about the research. I was asked to speak tonight because, not because I'm an expert on class size research, but because I have been a teacher for quite a long time. And I want to introduce a little bit, though, just by thinking about the research, because often when we are talking about class size, that is where the conversation begins. And there is so much research, and I think, as Kim has just pointed out, it is very important to pay attention to that research and to understand it. But all of the studies, although they help us understand the impact of class size on our children and our students, are a bit overwhelming. And every week, some new article lands on the staff room table. And as teachers, we really don't have time to go into it in the depth that Kim has. And so we find it a little hard to keep up. So we really need an efficient method of deciding what we think about this class size research. And fortunately for us, we have one. We run it through the filter of our own unique experience, and we decide whether it rings true or not. And quite honestly, the staff room conversation usually goes something like this. If the research on class size supports limits on class size, we nod, and then we wonder if anybody with any real authority in the system will listen to it. And if the research on class size limits does not support the limiting of class size, then we either just shake our heads and walk away, or we start questioning the motives behind the people who are doing the research or publishing the research. And when we get to that point, then we realize that we've actually become very cynical about class size research. And, I think that what we have to realize is that there are people who think that teachers are biased about class size research, and that our cynicism has maybe to do with some motivation to do what's right for us. And I think that if we argue that we are biased, and therefore we're not reliable evaluators of our own experience, then we need to ask ourselves some serious questions. If we can't evaluate our own experience in regard to class size, who else is going to report to you what it feels like to face a class of over 30 students? Who else is going to explain the disappointment of knowing that every day you can rarely engage in the thing that makes your job the most rewarding, and that's the one-to-one conversations with kids? Who else is going to know what it's like to learn about a fabulous technique at a Prodi workshop on Friday afternoon, and then try it out in your classroom on Monday morning, only to find that it flops because it just doesn't work when you have 32 grade fives? Who else is going to tell you what it's like to have too many hands in the air at once? And a bunch of those hands are waving impatiently, and then there's those other hands that are slowly sagging in discouragement when they can't get your attention. Who else is going to detail the exhaustion
of coping with marking and record keeping for 7 junior high English classes with over 30 students in each class. That teacher has well over 200 students. Who can tell you about the sense of loss that teachers experience when the individuality of those 200 students that she sees only every second day for an hour or so fades into a blur? And how disheartening it is to not really be able to answer with any confidence some crucial question a parent asks because you haven't had a chance to know their child as well as you should. Sure, we can always tell parents how a student is doing academically. Of course we can. But parents don't just send little scholars off to school. They send their children. And they don't worry only about academics. They worry about whether their children are happy. They worry about whether they're fitting in socially or are being teased or maybe even bullied. Whether they might be doing drugs. About how they're coping with a death or a divorce. About where they might have left that brand new jacket. About how they're adapting to a new school or a new country. The list is endless. You know that because most of you have wondered these things about your own children. And these are exactly the questions that teachers with large class sizes find most difficult to answer. To put it simply, that situation makes us sad. It takes the heart out of what we do for a living. These are not biases. And they're not exaggerations. They're the realities of the emotional and attitudinal impact of being a teacher with large classes. It's precisely because we have these experiences that we have become cynical about research that concludes that class size doesn't matter. It matters terribly. However, in order to run the impact of class size changes through my own experiential filter, I'm going to have to take you back quite a few years before some of you were born. After all, they did ask me to speak this evening because I've been around a long time. So I can share some historical perspective. I'm going to begin my little history with a grade 9 science class. Not one I taught, my grade 9 science class at New Westminster Secondary in 1968, which even then housed a few thousand students. They say that as you age, your memory of 40 years ago gets better than your memory of last week. To my horror, I think that's true. In any case, I'm going to tell you about this class because although I do remember being in very large classes in elementary and junior high, I was never too sure whether it was because I was little and my child-sized perspective made them seem large. But for this particular science class, I can be quite certain it had 40 students or more. Now, I know this because I counted the desks. You see, I wasn't very good at science. So I took a seat in the back to be as far away from the teacher, and the only lab table, which was on a raised platform at the front of the room, this really long, narrow classroom, and it didn't occur to me then that I would probably learn more if I could be one of the handful of students who were up near the front and could actually see the lab take place rather than just hear it described. But as it turned out, my teacher, this worked out well because he was really methodical. He would start on one side of the class and he would go up and down the rows asking for us to parrot back the answers to the reading comprehension questions we'd done out of the science textbook the night before. And I counted those rows and I know that each row had 8 students in it and there were 5 rows across and a few on the side because there was some big vent thing there. And I remember that really well. Because I knew that I could check and I could be sure that I could have my question that I was going to have to answer really ready when he got to me. So I don't think this necessarily meant that he was a bad teacher, because he had to cope. And a lot of people talk that way in those days. And that kind of coping, unfortunately, did not involve a lot of individual attention. So I was able to hide out and be not as quiet as I should have been, perhaps, but fairly quiet. It was so common, in fact, for the classes to be large at large schools like that and for us not to get the individual attention that I remember the next year, my grade 10 math teacher came and stood beside my desk and I thought I was in big trouble. And then she asked me if I wanted help with my math. And you know, that really confirms Kim's message about teachers caring. because I wasn't a very good math student either. And so I teach English. And yet that was my favorite math teacher, and I still remember her. So that must have been because of the one time she came and stood by my desk. Anyway, in that classroom, it wasn't as though in that kind of classroom in that at that time that you could turn to your classmates and get any help if you were stuck in math, because the classroom was supposed to be really quiet and really homogeneous, and it was. I mean, most of the people in my classroom were white. We were European-Canadian dominated. We were British-Canadian dominated. There were no ESL problems there, or none that were recognized as such anyway. And the slow learners were not in that class. They were in the occupational program, or they swam in the non-academic stream, or they simply dropped out of school. There was about a 60% graduation rate in those days, compared with close to 90% in recent years. So those who could not cope with the teachers who were merely coping simply disappeared. When I was in grade 11, though, I was really lucky because my family moved to Steveston. And in Steveston, it was a smaller community with a smaller school and smaller classes, and the faces were not all European Canadian. There was no AUC program, as we used to unkindly call it. And I became more of a person than a name on a list to most of my teachers. And that, for me, was a really dramatic lesson in the importance of class size from a student's perspective. Sometimes, at that school, we even got to sit in circles to discuss literature and history, and it was really hard to hang out in the back row. And I didn't know it at the time, but I was experiencing the beginnings of a change in education. And it was the blossoming of the idea that the student, not the program, should be the center of learning. By the time I became a teacher in the late 70s, I had begun to take these newer approaches to education as the norm. We learned them in SFU's excellent PDP program during our practicums. But when I got to my first job in Revelstoke, I learned what it meant to work in a boom town in which the school could hardly hold the number of students who kept showing up every day. I got my job in October, and I was hired because they were overflowing and they needed help. And I quickly discovered that my new teacher idealism and methodologies definitely work better in some classes than in others, and that the big difference was class size. So naturally, I wanted to do the best I could for my students, so I began to ask that my class sizes be limited. What a rookie. First they laughed. Then they patiently explained that it was a boom town and these were tough times, and I had to accept that, you know, that probably wasn't going to happen. And the ones that didn't laugh were offended because I thought I knew something they didn't, and they didn't like that. So I quickly learned my place, which was to ask politely to have working and learning conditions put into board policy, because teachers had no authority to bargain that kind of thing at that time. In fact, we didn't have very many rights at all, so we used to call it not collective bargaining, but collective begging in those days. It was a long struggle, but finally we got the right to unionize, and in the 80s, our conditions of work became bargainable. And one of the first things we put on the table was class size and class composition. We had literally years of talks on that topic. And each year we would iron out some unworkable aspect of the class size language and try to make it work. At first glance, class size limits sound simple, but they're anything but. Our board and bargaining team discussed language on at least 30 different aspects of this one working and learning condition alone. Related issues would arise almost every contract period, and there would be need to resolve that around the table. But patience and tolerance resulted in a situation that worked quite well. And that's where negotiations can lead us. One provision of our contract was that the class limit of 30 would be set for the secondary level. Still too high, really. And there would be a flex factor of 2 additional students to account for those who moved to town after school has begun in September. So at Fernie Secondary, where I now teach, but about a dozen years ago, I had an English 11 class with 30 students. At our school, We don't segregate communication students from English students until grade 12 when they write a different provincial exam. Communication students are not necessarily those with identified learning disabilities, but they are those who always struggled in language arts and usually struggled in school generally. They are the so-called gray area students who receive no extra support funding, no extra services. Often these students are taught in separate language arts classes, but we always believed that it was better to keep these students integrated and to accommodate to their instructional needs instead. So, in that class, I had 21 English students and 7 communication students. I also had 2 students who were on a school leaving certificate and came from the special education program and had a child care worker working with them. And there was also 1 ESL student. Can you imagine? Only 1. And a student with visual impairment for whom several accommodations were necessary. In addition, 2 of the students who had moderate to serious behavioral issues had to be kept apart because they hated one another. So, just to be clear, I believe that classes with challenging compositional issues are and should be the norm. Diversity is the norm in the larger society, and students' lives are richer when they have an opportunity to develop at school the tolerance and the courtesy that diversity demands of us all. No, the variability of the students was not my big issue. It was the size of the class, given its composition, that concerned me. So I went to the counselors and I asked them to please not put those 2 possible extra students into that particular class, no matter what. And they sent me to the principal's office. And when I asked the principal the same question, he said, go read your contract. Now, he wasn't trying to be mean or rude or retributive over some union issue. He has had other fish to fry. He had a timetable to balance and parents to meet when they moved into town and needed to enroll their children and many other masters to serve that I did not have to consider. He was in charge of what many would call the big picture. Unfortunately, that way of looking at things makes the students and the teacher in the classroom the little picture. And that clearly should not be the case.